From the Sky News Centre at 5, the co-pilot of the German Wings flight which crashed in the Alps seemingly hid an illness from his employers. Victoria Lawrence reports.
A German prosecutor says Andreas Lubitz had a sick note for the day the plane flew into the side of a mountain, but it had been ripped up.
Documents with medical contents were confiscated, which point towards an existing illness.
His employers are now facing questions over his mental condition. Aviation psychologist Professor Robert Ball.
His problem went literally below the radar.
Former pilot Captain Peter Benn is shocked no one knew.
I suspect it will come out in time that he acted with great cunning in concealing this.
Meanwhile, families of some of the victims have been to the scene of the crash today, which killed 150 people.
A British military health worker given an experimental drug after contracting Ebola in Sierra Leone has been given the all clear. 25-year-old Anna Cross from Cambridge has now been discharged from the Royal Free Hospital in London, where she was being treated. She's paid tribute to staff there at a news conference.
Thanks to the team here, who are, I would say, the best in the world, an absolutely incredible bunch of clinicians, incredibly skilled, incredibly intelligent, and incredibly professional. And yeah, thanks to them, I'm alive, so a huge thank you.
A man's been jailed for a year after internet paedophile hunters lured him into thinking he was meeting a 14-year-old girl. Two men from the group Dark Justice met and filmed John Rudd in Newcastle, where he was arrested minutes later. Police have revealed the name of an off-duty police officer arrested on suspicion of murdering his wife at their home in Northampton. Otis Goldsmith was taken into custody yesterday. Officers from neighbouring forces will investigate the case. The Labour leader's formally launched his party's general election campaign. Ed Miliband wants to restrict the profits private firms could earn from running NHS services. And Dermot O'Leary has quit as presenter of The X Factor. The host says it's time for him to move on. That's the latest. I'm Emma Jones.
Love Bristol. Love, love, love. BCFM 93.2.
It's Friday, 5 o'clock. Welcome to BCFM's Politics Show. Tony Gosling helping me review this week's news is the leader of Bristol Lib Dems and councillor for Knoll, Gary Hopkins. Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers is here too. After the 6 o'clock news, we have two of the hardest hitting journalists in the region. One is senior journalism lecturer at the University of the West of England, and the other used to make national documentaries for ITV, now works for the likes of Al Jazeera. We ask Phil Chamberlain and Tim Tate, is investigative journalism dead? Also, the Bishop of Guildford's banned him, but we haven't. He's the Reverend Stephen Sizer, world-renowned author on the phenomenon of Christian Zionism that's behind much of the so-called belief that the Israeli government is God's will in the world. This week we see what Christian Zionists say is in the Bible. Is it really? You've heard of the second coming of Christ, but Christian Zionists believe in a third coming too. As Yemen explodes into violence this week, we ask, what are the motives? Who's really behind this? That's all in the second hour after 6 o'clock. On to our news review in a minute, but first Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Tonight, lows of 7 degrees Celsius, patchy rain and fog. This weekend, highs of 13, wet and windy with gales at times. Next week, highs of 11, sunshine and showers with strong winds easing off as the week progresses. Next weekend, that's Easter weekend, the 4th and 5th is Saturday and Sunday, and the 6th is the Monday, that's Easter Monday, highs of 11 with sunny spells. That's good news. And that was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. So helping us review this week's news, it's the leader of Bristol Lib Dems and councillor for Knoll, Gary Hopkins. Hi, Gary. Welcome to the Politics Show. First of all, we've had a full council meeting since we last spoke to you, and I know that residence parking is quite high up the agenda for many people, and it's also talked a lot about at the City Council. So how's it all going? I know it's not looking good for the mayor, and there's been a lot of criticism, and there was a whole phalanx of campaigners against what's been going on at the full council meeting.
Yeah, that's certainly the case. possibly the most interesting bit, in actual fact, because there's a huge protest from business and a lot of residents who are very angry about the way that things are actually being done, and it's the imposition. But my colleague, who's a councillor for Cabot, actually related when the first...
That's
Alex Woodman. He actually related the first residence parking zone, a genuine residence parking zone, when it went in Kingsdown, because residents actually asked for it there, and it was done on a minimal cost basis. They weren't being ripped off, it wasn't being used as a tax, and they were actually asked what they wanted, and it worked. But the problem was, the mayor could have gone down that route, that model, but instead he's chose to impose over a large area very quickly, and using it as a tax-raising method rather than just to cover the basic costs, and it's caused a huge amount of anger.
But Gary, if the mayor, George Ferguson, was here, he'd gently slap you around a little bit, wouldn't he? He'd say, well, hang on a minute, we did consultations everywhere in the city.
No, they didn't actually ask anybody, do you want this or not?
Well, they did consultations about how it was going to be implemented, didn't they?
There were a number of details that were adjusted, but the basic concept of, do you want this, was never asked but under his model, which is a severe mistake, because actually people who were particularly ambivalent about it, all of a sudden they become negative and actually are fighting to stop things being imposed upon them, and that's part of the reason why things have gone so badly. But really it's a matter of not being realistic with what you can do and what you can't do. If you want to actually dissuade commuters, then there are various ways of doing it. It doesn't need the 9-to-5 or a 9-to-9 scheme, as he's actually imposing in Clifton, to actually solve the problem. What was also interesting was councillors from all parties who was, and I mean all parties, who were saying, well, we're not against the concept, but the way it's being done in my area is causing huge anger.
OK, well, look, let's get into some detail, Gary, because it's all very well saying, oh, the way it's being done is no good, but tell me exactly what you would have done differently if you'd have been involved in this, and what residents are calling for. So the detail, the minutiae of what would have been different about about a scheme.
What we would do different is what we did do different, because Kingsdown in Cabot Ward was actually put in. At the same time, we actually asked residents in Clifton Wood, do you want this? Give them a general outline, and they actually said no, so that scheme didn't actually proceed. Now, the difference was taking time allows you to actually get the details right, and that's been one of the major problems. Trying to do everything very quickly and also trying to raise money from it has actually caused the problem. There isn't the capacity within the council structures to actually make this work if you try to do it too quickly.
And one of the problems I know I've seen quite a lot of, and I've heard anecdotal evidence of it as well, is people actually having problems even getting parking permits.
Yes, the administration has not been good, the lining out has not been done properly, the signs haven't been done properly, but again, this is just a symptom of trying to do things in a great rush rather than taking your time and doing it stage by stage.
Well, I mean, a lot of people would say that it took you far too long to bring in, for example, in St Paul's, where it was desperately needed. I mean, it's being used as a massive car park, St Paul's, for people working in the city centre. And George actually got elected on sorting this out, didn't he?
No. He actually hid the fact that he was going to bring in residence parking and specifically kept it out of his manifesto. We know that because we spoke to the people who advised him not to put it in.
Okay. Also, lots of other stuff going on. I think, you know, some of these long-running issues, which for me, I mean, particularly with the arena, we've had this absolute eyesore right next to Templemead Station, just to the south of the station, for at least a decade, probably more than that now, maybe 15 years. I'm not sure how long that old site's been derelict. We've also got the road closed off there for months and months. It's like some kind of, you know, desperately pleading, do something with this land. And what the city council now planning to do, it seems, is this arena, but we've not really been told whether this is going to stack up financially. Particularly haven't been told about whether there's going to be sufficient parking on the site. What's the latest on the arena, Gary? What have you heard?
Well, there isn't going to be sufficient parking on the site, and basically I know that the mayor was looking at a number of different options, and then when all of them fell by the wayside, he then came up with the principal decision: we didn't need parking. In actual fact, it's because decent local clerk and couldn't actually be found at a sensible price, which is a very different story than, you know, we don't need it.
Well, I mean, every stadium is going to need a massive amount of parking. There's no doubt about that.
It does have some advantages in being next to the station, you know, so that will...
Well, not everyone's going to come by train.
Oh, absolutely not. No, no, no. But that does give a bit of an advantage, but certainly there's going to be an awful lot of cars and they're going to be looking for somewhere to park. And we've been banging on at the Mayor for quite some while about protecting the local residents from overflow parking, but also looking at improving the transport links, which are going to be absolutely necessary for the place not to jam up completely. Now, we've had various stories about when this scheme, you know, the transport plan is going to be available. The latest estimate is June, when we're going to look at it. And although we were given January a few months ago, and then that's going to come in front of scrutiny in June, with a cabinet decision in July.
So has money already been set aside for this?
There's an overall budget for some transport planning, but as of yet, no detail. And it's actually quite difficult to see how they constructed a budget of how much it's actually going to cost when they don't know what they're going to do.
Yeah, one would have thought that they've got the cart before the horse there a bit, because you would look at a plan, particularly the maps of what's going to happen, the financial plan, does it stack up financially, and then you say, we want to do this. But no, it seems that they've said they want to do it before they've actually looked at whether it stacks up or not.
I think that's pretty accurate. I hope they're going to be slightly more modern than carts and horses, but you never do know, do you?
Also, we've got a bit of news today. The council's been handed the land for the Bristol Arena. So apparently the Bristol Arena is going to go on that land. That is by the government. Bristol's £91 million. It's gone up a million since I last saw. Entertainment Arena's taken another step forward after the land for the site was formally handed over to the City Council. The agreement will also see £5.4 million of government funding to the city to help develop other sites within the Temple Quarter Enterprise Zone. Bristol's Mayor George Ferguson described the deal as a vital step. Early this month, Populous was chosen to build the 12,000-seat venue, which is due to open in 2017. Companies behind the London Olympic Stadium and the O2 Arena in London, Berlin and Dublin was chosen from a shortlist of five. It will be located at the former diesel depot site next to Temple Meads Railway Station. Well, it does, I mean, from what they're saying on the BBC website here today, Gary, sounds like it's all got the green light, it's all going ahead.
Well, I don't think there's any major problem with regard to the construction of it. I think there's certainly the demand so that it should stack up. In fact, the biggest barrier to this was the Regional Non-Development Agency before. They actually controlled the land, and they were the barrier. And everyone was having a go at the council, why aren't you doing something about it? In actual fact, the council weren't in control. Now, that situation has effectively been changed. And in actual fact, the city deal that was done about three, four years ago, which the mayor, by the way, still hasn't formally signed off, but he should do, because it involves the other three authorities as well. The city deal actually provided the majority of the finance. It's then a matter of moving steadily along and fitting in the blocks into the jigsaw. But I'm afraid the biggest block that's not been properly tackled is the transport and the planning that goes with it.
Over the last few weeks, we've been discussing just generally the way that the local media cover stories in the city. And I've been finding a very strange, spooky correlation between the stories in something called Southwest Business News, which is related quite closely to Business West, which is the Southwest Chamber of Commerce or Bristol Chamber of Commerce, and the Bristol Post website. Same stories in both. I mean, I'm not quite sure which one is copying the other. But anyway, Gary, what's your thoughts about generally about BBC, ITV, all of the media, because we'll be talking about it in the second hour. Is investigative journalism still alive or is it dead? We'll be talking about that after 6 o'clock. But what's your thoughts about the way, particularly the political issues in the city, things that come up at the council are covered?
I think there's very little investigative journalism. ITV locally sort of faded away some while ago when they went to too big an area and therefore couldn't concentrate properly on the stories in Bristol. The BBC sometimes do some interesting work, but it's a bit patchy. And the Post, well, you know, that stopped being a newspaper years and years ago, so, you know, can't really be taken seriously.
Well, it is a newspaper. People buy it, don't they? I mean, they read it.
Not many.
No?
No, I mean, their circulation figures have gone down and down and down. You know, my local news agent says that more people read our political newsletter than read the Post, you know, and he's a news agent, so...
Well, you're shoving it through people's doors, I suppose, aren't you?
Well, we are, but, you know, it's read, it's understood, you know, and people get information. Less and less people are reading the Post. You know, there's nothing in there that you want to see, and they don't actually... trust a lot of the information that's actually in there. That's a big test for a newspaper, not just how much is in there, but do people actually believe it when they see it in there?
Well, we read out a story from the Bristol Post last week about the merger of some of the services between Avon and Somerset Police and Wiltshire Police. It didn't actually say anything in the story about what kind of services were going to be merged. It was just a sort of very, very sketchy from a long, long way away view. Do you think that's typical?
Well, the fact that they covered it at all is probably not typical, but, you know, I know a little bit about the story because I'm slightly involved.
Well, maybe you can tell us. Could you?
Yeah, a little bit. I mean, it's mainly back office, which is, you know, personnel, all that sort of stuff, which can effectively be done between different authorities. It's not a merger. The bit that is a bit concerning is when you merge things like, you know, the police dogs, like the forensics, etc., which is it's done by non-warranted officers, and some of the problem there can be delay in the service, extra travel times, that sort of thing. So some of the things can actually be done with a genuine saving and not affecting services. Some of them look okay on paper, but they can produce less efficient service.
Finally, the mayor, how's it all going, and are we going to get a chance to vote again at some point on a referendum as to whether we think the mayor has worked or whether we want to go back to the old system?
Well, it's actually been raised in Parliament, and all of the parties in Bristol agreed to lobby their national leadership, which they have now done, in terms of bringing that forward. Unfortunately, we've got this general election, which is sort of getting in the way of progress on that, but I think there's genuine agreement from all parties in Bristol that there needs to be significant reform, and that people in Bristol ought to have the genuine democratic right to decide whether the system's worked or not.
Well, why do you think we need to have that opportunity for a vote then?
It is staggering how many people start off conversation with, well, I voted for a mayor, but... and, you know, it's staggeringly common. And huge numbers of other people have said, well, I didn't vote in the referendum because I didn't really think it affected us, and now I realise that it does.
So how has it affected the city? What, you know, from your, you know, take the long view, if you would, what are the main changes that have actually played out since we got a mayor?
A lack of accountability, a lack of information for the public, and a rather skewed approach to the way things are actually done. So rather than and things being done in a hurry and then having to be undone or changed partway through, quick decisions quite often, but uninformed decisions.
Okay, Gary, we're also joined in the studio by Joe Moss from Bristol Cannabis Club. Hi, Joe. Welcome to the Politics Show.
Hi, Tony.
Now, you've got what you're calling a cannabis education event going on this weekend. I think it's tomorrow. First of all, can you tell us why you're holding this event?
Just to bring more awareness to the positive effects of cannabis, and also to promote things locally rather than on a national level and get people included in a debate and dialogue.
And what are the sort of issues you'd be looking at? I mean, I know, for example, in this week there was a story in the news about cannabis and health. I'm not sure if it was to do with actually cancer or something like that. But anyway, give us an idea of the sorts of things that you think cannabis is actually good for.
Well, the stories we've been hearing recently about people using cannabis oil to treat cancer, the evidence is with some people it seems to work, with some people it doesn't. I think, yes, that's the same for everything. People bandy the word cure around, but I don't think it's particularly helpful. I think people just need to wait and see what happens. But
I mean, do you actually have any evidence of cannabis being good for people's health, or is I mean, well, what's that evidence like?
There's growing research. The UK is very slow because the illegal position hasn't allowed much research to readily take place. I use cannabis for medicinal purposes myself, and it's been very therapeutic and very useful. I see people around me all the time with campaigning for people who use cannabis medicinally and recreationally. For medicinal purposes, it's things like multiple sclerosis, rheumatoid arthritis, depression. And surprisingly, some people even use certain strains of cannabis to help with their mental health problems, which is quite contrary to the stuff that's been in the press recently.
Okay, so how would you argue against that then? Because we do hear quite a lot, don't we, that cannabis, some particularly strong versions of it, like skunk, can actually tip people over the edge. So is that not the case?
Skunk is just one strain of high THC cannabis. There's probably around 5,000 different strains. A skunk is a term the media latched onto. However, some cannabis does have a high THC content, and for some people it's not ideal. In a regulated system, you'd be able to choose cannabis to suit what you needed. There's another component to cannabis called CBD, which can actually reverse the effects of nullify the effects of THC so that people don't have enhanced mental health problems.
Okay, what about evidence, though? Come on, let's have some evidence. What sort of things... I mean, for anyone listening that's thinking, can cannabis, or maybe heard rumours that cannabis can help, what evidence do we have of which kinds of illnesses that there might be some, it may be in a different world, doctors would be prescribing cannabis for?
Well, you only have to go and look at and see what GW Pharmaceuticals are doing with their research. They have patented cannabis preparations for multiple sclerosis and also neurological conditions. That is a product called Sativex. I'm not going to carry on promoting them, but they're running trials into treatments for epilepsy, and in the States they've filed lots of different patents for cannabis therapeutics for cancer.
Now, I notice you've got some interesting people coming to Bristol for this event tomorrow. Chico Ryder, he's the son of the Happy Mondays bass player, Paul Ryder, and he wants to tell a story about using cannabis oil to treat his cancer.
Yeah, he's luckily enough that he lives in California with his parents, where medical cannabis is available. You'd go to a dispensary, you get a medical card, so they're not acting outside of the law. They used it alongside his other treatment, and the results have been amazing, and he's recovered his health.
Now, I was quite surprised to see on your list of people who are going a couple of chief constables, former chief constable Tom Lloyd.
Yes, Tom.
International drug policy advisor, former chief constable, experience in the UK and many countries he's visited around the world has led him to the conclusion that prohibition is a hugely costly, counterproductive and harmful failure.
Yes, he does, and he has quite a lot to say about it. Tom was at the HASC conference a couple of weeks ago.
What's that?
The Home Affairs Select Committee, of Commons, it was at the International Drug Policy Conference leading up to UNGAS next year, and Tom was one of the speakers there and took part in one of the panels alongside other serving and ex-officers and a police crime commissioner, and they all were of the opinion that the drug laws don't work.
Also, Neil Woods.
Yes.
He was in Derbyshire Constabulary after 23 years as a police officer. He spent 14 years as a drugs undercover operative before going on to develop tactics and training programmes for undercover officers. And he went into CID in Derbyshire. So he sounds like quite an interesting chap. These are people who've been at the cutting edge of actually investigating drug crime, and they're all basically saying that this drug needs to be decriminalised.
They are very much indeed. Neil actually was on the Drugs Live programme on Channel 4 a few weeks back, and he said then about how the war on drugs has completely failed, and when you've got the drug gangs infiltrating the police, that there's no way forward with this. There needs to be done on relative harms, and they're both of the opinion that all drugs should be regulated, not criminalised, not put into the hands of people who don't ask for ID.
Martin, that's an interesting one, isn't it? Because old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers, you're always wondering, aren't you, are the police infiltrating the drug gangs, or are the drug gangs infiltrating the police? Which is it?
Well, I mean, if you look at Latin America, it's fairly clear that it's a two-way street. I think the time has come for this discussion. In Latin America, the major politicians across the political spectrum are saying we have got to legalise drugs. Not are we going to legalise drugs? We've
we
got to
why?
Do this.
Why?
Because the corruption associated with the illegality has rotted the social structure in those countries completely. And if you think back to the 1980s, the Iran-Contra affair, so-called, where Colonel Oliver North was bringing huge amounts of cocaine into the United States through MENA Air Base in Arkansas mainly, and they were distributing it to the drug gangs in the big cities and using the funds to fund the contra-terrorist campaign in Nicaragua against the democratically elected government of Nicaragua. People in Latin America know about this stuff. People over here are basically fed a diet of nonsense by the red-top newspapers. And I mean, I'm afraid the mainstream political leadership are terrified of this kind of discussion because they know they're going to get screams of outrage from people who know nothing about what they're talking about.
But you can't simply decriminalise drugs, surely make them easily available to teenagers?
Decriminalisation, which is what's happened in other parts of Europe, for example, like Portugal, is a halfway house because the criminals still control the market. And the only way to really seriously deal with this is to legalise and regulate. And I'm not in favour of a free market in drugs. I'm not in favour of a free market in everything. But people should be able... I mean, for example, we've known for years that people are addicted to heroin. If you just give them heroin, they can actually live a reasonable life. And at some point, they may decide to give it up. But if they don't, if they go to the black market for it, that's when they lie, steal, sell their bodies and all the rest of it. Think about the consequences of HIV infection and so on. All of this, we've just got to change our attitude towards it. I don't think that drugs are always good for people. I think that's absurd. You know, look around the city centre of a Friday night and look at people drinking. It's not doing them any good, is it? But I mean, the point is that we've got to be we've got to have a rational adult conversation about this, because it's got to a point where it's just getting silly, where the banks, for example, are massively laundering drug money. HSBC were caught doing exactly that. They were given a slap on the wrist, and then Lord Green was then taken into the
That's interesting, isn't it? A relationship between the big banks and the drug cartels. Yeah. I mean,
in Latin America, people see the US opposition to legalization of drugs as being part of defending their position, because they use the funds from those illegal drugs to fund their political allies, like the AUC or to Unidas Defensas in Colombia, with the right-wing paramilitaries funded by drugs. And of course, illegal drugs are much more much more profitable than legal drugs.
I think maybe you should be doing a talk tomorrow, Martin. Anyway, Gary Hopkins, what do you make of this from a more mainstream political point of view?
Well, it's absolutely true that, to give cannabis as an example, it's got some very beneficial features for a number of people. Partly, it can also be potentially harmful, some strains, with the wrong people. But you're not exactly going to get the right prescription if you're buying it from an illegal dealer.
Where would you draw the line between medical use and actually completely decriminalising it and bring it within the, I suppose, like cigarettes or something, which you tax and get duty from?
Yes, and actually, cigarettes are probably more harmful than cannabis.
Yeah, Joe's nodding there.
and they're extremely harmful. That doesn't mean to say that you hand them around completely freely. You do need to have a system thought through in advance before you change the rules and regulations and laws as to how you might actually educate and control the supplies. And that's the key thing. A lot of the drugs are extremely harmful, never mind whether they're legal or not. And if you just throw the doors open without having thought it through in advance, then you're going to get a lot of problems. But it is certainly the case that the present system does not work. And you've only got to look back to 1920s, 1930s America to see, you know, Prohibition was the classic example. And when they actually legalised alcohol again, well, you know, it's not the perfect substance. You know, lots of religions are very concerned about alcohol. But, you know, it's causing less problems now in America than it was when it was illegal.
Amazing. All right. Also, Joe, I know you've come back from Spain recently. And Spain, what's the situation? I think isn't it decriminalised in Spain? So
yes.
How does that work?
The tolerance. It's decriminalised. Just because it's decriminalised doesn't mean to say there aren't civil penalties. If you get caught on the street with cannabis, then you can be fined up to €300. It can increase if you don't pay, or it's a second offence. But you don't become a criminal. It is a civil penalty. But how they manage this, in Spain they have cannabis associations or cannabis clubs where residents can join the cannabis associations. They pay a yearly fee, and then they get their cannabis a decent price, and they can choose different strains, they can choose different types, they can choose extract or buds, and they can actually choose it for the THC or CBD levels that are good for them.
And does it work?
It seems to.
Okay, just remind us where and when your event's taking place.
Okay.
Tomorrow
the event is from 4:45 p.m. at the Phoenix Social Enterprise building in Redfield in Bristol.
And it's the times again?
Sorry, 4:45 p.m.
Okay, and that is actually here in Russell Town Avenue, which is where we are at the City Academy, just across the road, or just down the road, Phoenix Social Enterprise Main Hall, 5 Russell Town Avenue, Redfield here in Bristol. Well, Joe Moss, thanks very much for joining us today. And there's a bit of sad news this week. Tributes have been pouring in Marlborough for wartime codebreaker Harry Bekoff, who died on Sunday last week, last Sunday, age 101. Harry Bekoff, who lived in Castle Court retirement apartments in River Park, grew up in Bristol, attending Fairfield Grammar School and studying at Bristol University. He was a colonel in the Intelligence Corps and a codebreaker at Bletchley Park during the Second World War. And the reason I mention the demise of poor old Harry is because he came onto this show several times, even when he was 98 years old. A couple of years he did one of our Christmas news reviews, which was quite interesting. He was very much against the European Union, so it would be interesting to see what Gary Hopkins has got to say after we hear a bit from Harry. But let's go back to that interview a couple of years ago now and hear from Harry Bekoff, who it describes how he first went to Germany and how at the course he was doing in German at Bristol University, he was awarded his degree by none other than Winston Churchill. Martin, just tell us a little bit about Harry, because you met him, I know, didn't you?
Well, he was a very intelligent. He was the oldest living member of the Conservative Party. So he joined the Conservative Party in the the 40s.
The longest serving member. He joined when he was 15 years old.
Yeah, he was very anti-European Union. But a very interesting gentleman with a lot of unorthodox views. You wouldn't think of him, you know, he wasn't a knee-jerk of any kind, was he?
No. The other thing that Harry's quite famous for is he was one of the people that has been making quite a big fuss about a certain chap called Martin Bormann, who he believed had got all the sort of the keys to the Nazi bank accounts, took them out of Germany right at the very end of the war with the aid of M-Section, MI6, Ian Fleming and people like that, and got them squirreled over to South America, and actually created a kind of financial empire from the proceeds of all the looting of Europe in World War II.
Yeah, well, that's all covered in Paul Manning's book, Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile. And also, there's another very important book about these issues by
Christopher Crichton. His actual real name is John Ainsworth Davis.
Yeah, John Ainsworth Davis. That's why I mentioned John Ainsworth, which is called Operation JB, which is about the operation to spring Martin Bormann out of Germany at the end of the war, carried out by a very secret section of MI6. You know, this linkages between the Nazi intelligence structure and the setting up of NATO are still with us. If you look at the linkages between the far-right groups in the Ukraine, for example, at the minute, working with NATO intelligence services on various nefarious plots and plans.
Well, I hope we can hear from Harry now as he describes his first trip to Germany while he was studying here at Bristol University.
I chose to go to Freiburg in the Black Forest because it looked very tempting to me. And I went there in 1933 and witnessed the arrival of Hitler into power. And I saw his Nazi armies. I saw some of the lecturers in the university get dressed in Nazi uniform. That's why I spent more time in the Black Forest than I did in the university. But I witnessed things like burning of books in the marketplace. I saw some dreadful things in Germany. I met many people who were begging me to help them get out of the country. Not a very easy thing to do for a penniless student. And so when I came back to England, I went back to my university, and the Chancellor happened to be a gentleman with the name of Winston Churchill. And Churchill handed me my first degree, and I told him I'd just come back from Germany, and he said, We'll have a chat afterwards. And that's how I got to know Churchill, and he explained to me what was going on. I learned more in depth in a few meetings with Churchill than I had in the time I'd spent in Germany. So I knew what he was going through, and I knew the problems which faced us. He was put into power. Hitler had no money, had managed to reach the rank of Lance Corporal and Corporal in the German army, though he was Austrian birth, was latterly put in prison, had no money whatsoever, started up this sort of League of Brigands in southern Germany, but there was no money available. However, the powers that be, who came from the Illuminati and were the richest people in the world, beginning with the Rothschilds, whose history needs a complete book in itself, decided that Hitler was the man they were going to put in place in Germany. Part of their plans for the recrudescence of the whole of Europe and, in fact, of the world. That's how he came into power. He had no great education. He had no great knowledge. He had no money. He came from poor parents. His trade was painting, decorating. But he was out of work and in prison for ages. So how does a man like that suddenly vault into power as the prime minister of a country whose great general is just dying?
Yeah, so how did Hitler get into power so quickly? Martin, what Harry's saying there is the thing that surprised them as intelligence officers during the war and after the war was that, Hitler had such a very fast rise to power from almost nothing, and there seemed to be a lot of money behind what he was doing.
Well, the Communist Party in Germany at the time and the left were very strong. And, of course, the industrialists and the bourgeoisie, for want of a better word, were very scared of a revolution. So they thought they could use Hitler to crush the communists, which he did. But then, of course, he to some extent, he then took control of the situation. Very similar to the way Vladimir Putin came to power in Russia, because he was brought to power by the oligarchy to defeat the communists. He defeated the communists, although they're still in contention. And then, of course, he double-crossed the oligarchy that brought him to power. But, of course, these are very murky waters, and we still live in a times run by oligarchic politics.
And the other thing about Harry was that the first David Cameron as Prime Minister, the first party conference, Harry was there and he got a standing ovation, the entire party, Conservative Party, clapping and cheering. I haven't heard a lot from them actually commemorating his life. Now he's dead. But anyway, there's the most fascinating thing, was it one of the things anyway about Harry, or the thousands of fascinating things about him really, was that he was actually there in Berlin at the Hitler bunker when the war finally finished in beginning of May 1945. And here he talks about that, and he certainly wasn't convinced that Hitler died, which is quite an interesting thing. He saw the bit of tarpaulin, but he wasn't allowed to touch anything, and so he was rather worried that Hitler had been somehow spirited away somewhere. Anyway, he was much more worried, though, about Martin Bormann and the bank account, so let's hear about that now.
Some of the leaders of the Nazis were quite aware by the end of 1943 that they were going to face defeat. They began planning immediately. Hitler, for instance, had a right-hand man, and he told him to prepare for recrudescence, for rebirth of the Nazi Party after the war.
That's Martin Bormann, Harry, isn't it?
And he was a very shrewd, clever operator. In fact, he pretended to be killed when we attacked Berlin. And Hitler committed suicide. And I saw what reputed to be his body outside his bunker. He was the man who was given the job of getting all the leading Nazis possible out of Germany with all their plunder. And remember, they had plunder in not billions, trillions, as much gold, silver and jewels as they could steal from all the Jews they killed off, from all the other organizations and countries they plundered. Every country they went into, they plundered everything, including beautiful portraits, wonderful jewellery, gold, silver. They had a tremendous fortune, which they smuggled out of Germany, it is said, with the help of the Pope of that time, who helped them with what were called rat lines. Out they went in thousands, all over the world, including Mexico, South America. They established new businesses in different countries, which produced salient profits. They set up their own headquarters of an international office and kept in touch with what was going on in Germany. And that's written in my book on Germany. So by one means or another, and they were very clever at it, with the help of organizations like IG Farben, who have an American setup, they produced all the poison drugs to kill off the Jews. They had tremendous fortunes, and they helped all these leading Nazis out of Germany and into jobs.
The voice of Harry Bekoff there, but I will say he wasn't just talking about the war. He also had some pretty strong views about the modern world. And can you just sum up the sort of Harry view of the world? I mean, it's not one that everyone agrees with, but I mean, this it's quite fascinating to have had the insight of chatting with somebody, and I'll put the links on to those old programmes on our show page at thisweek.org.uk to someone who was actually around in the 1930s, visited Germany and saw Hitler's rise to power, saw the book burning and this kind of thing. It's almost something that's been completely forgotten today.
Well, and also he served with distinction in the Second World War as an intelligence officer, and I think his views in later life, from my point of view, is very, very Eurosceptic, to the point of completely dismissing the European Union as anything other than a fraud. But then that's not uncommon in the Tory party, let's face it. And in other ways, he was a very, very interesting gentleman and someone who will be sorely missed.
Gary, what about this? I mean, his points about the European Union are pretty strong, aren't they? He's saying basically that many of the laws that are made in this country actually come from the EU. And isn't it better for us as a nation to be electing people to Westminster to make laws here in Britain?
Well, we actually elect people to Westminster to make laws. We also elect people to European Union level to make laws. And we also elect people to councils, but unfortunately they don't make laws.
No, you don't. And also, I mean, there is a big democratic deficit now with the mayor, isn't there?
Yes, it's a considerable problem. And I didn't think it was quite possible for, you know, the changes to actually have such an effect on the party structures in Bristol, but the cooperation between the political parties in Bristol is now far better than it's been for years, but not for the reasons that the mayor is actually would want.
Okay, also another story this week. UK inflation is hitting zero for the first time on record. Falls in food and fuel prices mean consumer prices index, UK's official inflation measure, has not been so low since comparable records began back in 1989. Martin, what do you make of this? Does it matter? We've got zero inflation?
Well, I mean, the real fear is that the world is moving into deflation, falling prices. Which
I know Mark Carney's actually saying that the Eurozone is much more in danger of that than Britain. Right, is that true?
Well, I mean, the point is that's the way the wind is blowing. But, I mean, I have some doubts about inflation figures because they keep changing the way they're measured. So you have a basket of goods which has changed all the time. So the basket of goods in the 1950s, for example, included a certain proportion of lard, which is no longer included in the CPI for obvious reasons because people don't use lard very much anymore. But it means, for example, it cuts out things like housing costs. I mean, people's housing costs are, in fact, squeezing their incomes. So the CPI is actually not really a very good measure of what's going on.
Zero inflation, Gary, does it matter? Does it make any difference to our lives?
Yes, it does make quite a significant difference. And there are a number of different measures of inflation. And the different measures apply differently to different groups of people. Mm. You know, if you're a pensioner, you experience very different inflation because you use different things than if you're a 25-year-old. And I think that that the different measures need to be taken into account rather than just looking at one figure, which happens to be quite handy for the government at the time. Mind you have to laugh at Miliband with, because it was, oh, there's no growth in the economy. Oh, hang on, yes, there is. Ah, yes, but prices are rising quickly and people are being squeezed. Well, actually, prices aren't rising quickly. There are problems out there, but he keeps picking on the wrong ones.
It's the last Prime Minister's questions. It was this week on Wednesday. Let's go back now to Wednesday to Ed Miliband and David Cameron. And it was talking about, are there going to be more cuts? Ed was asking David Cameron, are there going to be more cuts in the next general election?
Can he confirm that the spending cuts he plans in the next 3 years will be greater even than anything seen in the last five?
Well, he's wrong about that, but look, straight answer from me, straight question to him. I have ruled out VAT. Will he rule out national insurance contributions? Yes or no?
He'll have plenty of time to ask questions after May the 7th. And I'm afraid to say, his own Office of Budget Responsibility says a much sharper squeeze on real spending than anything seen over the past 5 years. Next question, and this should be an easier one. 5 years ago, he promised to cut net migration to the tens of thousands. Straight answer to a straight question, is that a broken promise? Yes or no?
Let me give him a second chance. I answered a very simple question about VAT. I ruled out an increase. Let me ask him again. Will he rule out an increase in national insurance contributions? We all know this is Labour's jobs tax. This is their tax of choice.
Well, a bit of a bizarre topsy-turvy last Prime Minister's questions there, Gary Hopkins, because that seemed to be that actually David Cameron was asking more questions than Ed Miliband. And Ed quite sort of cleverly, for a rare bit of thinking on his feet, actually was saying, well, you'll have plenty of time to ask me questions after the election.
Yeah, I think he probably prepared that beforehand. but having said that, I mean, the clue is in the name, Prime Minister's Questions. And I think it's rather disingenuous for the Prime Minister to be turning back to be demanding answers to questions when he's been ducking debates. And I really do think he does have a lot of questions to actually answer. I'm very concerned about the Conservative plans in terms of budget. We do need to close the gap. We do need to make certain that things are balanced. But the way that they're going about it is entirely wrong. And I think that, when you look at public services, I'm concerned that there's a fair amount of leeway still yet in the council budget. But with regard to the police, the way that they're being squeezed, I think that that is potentially quite dangerous. And I think that a number of the spending cuts have been made in the wrong place.
It's a bit late for saying that because your party's in coalition with these guys. You've been propping up the David Cameron in power.
Well, we've actually been operating a coalition to rescue the country from a desperate mess that it was actually in. And overall, the general direction to date has been, as good as could be expected. I mean, I've even seen, right-wing Tories on the telly today admitting that it's been phenomenally better than they actually expected, and that things have actually worked. But when you're actually squeezing down spending on a department, up to a certain point, you squeeze efficiency. After a certain point, you actually then damage the service. And I'm afraid the way that the Conservatives, the direction that they're proposing to go over the next few years, will damage seriously damage a number of public services.
What about your point on the debates? Because this is quite an important part of whether, framing which way people vote. They will look at those debates and quite a lot of people will say, well, I think he did better, I'm going to vote for this guy.
Yes, I hope that people don't make up their mind just on 1 hour's telly, because there is a huge number of issues to look at.
But apparently there's a lot of people still undecided.
There are. I mean, that's certainly been my experience out there, that people who voted in a certain way last time saying, well, I'm not very sure.
Is that because most of the main parties are all the same and none of them are very... People don't feel particularly positive about voting for any of them?
I think there's a disillusionment with a lot of mainstream politics. The trouble is, when they turn to some of the other alternatives, they, if once they start checking into them, they find out that they don't work at all.
But you're in mainstream politics.
I am in mainstream politics, but I think I would have to say that we're probably at the more innovative and radical edge of it, rather than some of the pronouncements from the Labour and Tory parties. We are in favour.
Well, Danny Alexander's been accused of being more Tory than the Tory party, hasn't he? He's your main man in the Treasury.
Danny Alexander has managed to actually rescue the country from a desperate mess. We've actually managed to prioritise getting tax cuts down to the lower paid, which is what the Tories said was totally and absolutely impossible. That's worked. We've managed to protect the number of services which the Tories would have cut. And in actual fact, whilst squeezing down the deficit situation, which is necessary, then basically I think that overall the country's in reasonable shape. Not everything's gone right, and we don't agree with everything that the government has done. We've had to make compromises.
Martin?
Well, I'm glad to hear you say about public services. I think they are ideological in their approach. They're not being realistic. And I would also say that
when you say ideological, what's the motive?
Well, they want to shrink the state because it suits their ideology. So, in other words, we could argue about we've got to control the deficit, and something's got to be done about it. If in the early years of the coalition, if you remember, when they jammed the anchors on, the economy flatlined and the deficit didn't go down, and in actual fact it hasn't gone down in one term of parliament, which is what basically Ed Ball said at the very beginning. So he's as the election came closer, he's taken his foot off the brake, but that's actually more by good luck than good management, frankly. And don't forget, we did lose our credit rating in the early stages of the coalition. We are no longer a AAA rated country as a result of George Osborne. We've managed by some kind of Laurel and Hardy method to get over the line. But the fact is, of course, ultimately, the real problem is that the financial sector is still insolvent, and there's quite possibly, as David Cameron pointed out when he came back from the G20 summit, there's quite possibly going to be a global crash, which will be in the City of London at the centre of it. And that will be for the next prime minister to deal with, I suspect.
Oh, we're certainly not out of the woods yet.
No way.
I think there's an awful lot more steady work has actually got to be done. But quite frankly, breaking public services is not the way forward.
No, it's not.
But also, neither is ignoring a problem, putting your fingers in your ears and saying la la la, which is what Ed Balls and co would actually do, because then they're not facing up to the problem.
Well, come on, Martin.
Well, the real problem is the insolvency of the financial sector, based largely in Wall Street in the City of London. There's every possibility that a Grexit or a Chinese property crash is going to bring down the international financial system. Nothing has been done to reform it. We've had 5 years of fiddling while Rome burned. The Labour leadership haven't thought this through either.
Well, New Labour are part of creating the problem in the first place, weren't they?
I'm quite sure that people like Mike Carney know what I'm talking about. But the reason why the mainstream politicians don't want to talk about this is because ordinary people don't want to hear it, and it just frightens them. And the fact is that we haven't reformed the financial sector. There's every possibility of a further crash, and when we have that further crash, we won't be talking in the way we're talking now. We'll be talking very differently.
Well, one story this week, I think it was Monday, Theresa May announced a final, I suppose, before the general election, crackdown on hate preachers and what she calls the intolerance. So let's have a listen to the Home Secretary, who's in the running to take over the Conservative Party from David Cameron at some point, we're not sure quite when. Theresa May announcing her new policies on what are we going to do about these radical hate preachers. What I was hearing on the news on Monday was this incredible statement. We're going to be intolerant of intolerance, Gary. Do you make of this?
There's a fine line between allowing free speech, which is what you should do, and actually defeat the extremist with argument. As soon as you actually push things underground without tackling the root cause, you're going to have bigger problems.
Well, she's saying the game is up, Theresa May. That's part of her statement on Monday.
Well, if you're actually inciting hatred and if you're inciting violence, then that is unacceptable. If you're actually speaking, expressing radical views, that's a different matter.
Well, I'm going to exercise my free speech now and say many of these hate preachers, let's say so-called, have been demonstrably shown to be agents of the intelligence services. So in other words, this is largely a confected threat. And the threat to freedom of speech is people like me, for example, saying, or the Reverend Sizer pointing out the Israeli connections to 9/11. You say, you can't say things like that, that's anti-Semitic. No, it's not. We've got a whole list of factual matters that we need to discuss. A lot of terrorism around the world has been orchestrated by NATO intelligence services. Think about Syria. That's freedom of speech. We're going to have some serious arrests at the top in this country. And Theresa May knows what I'm talking about.
Well, local MP Chris Skidmore, who I've tried several times to get involved in our BCFM politics show, MP's debate, don't hear anything back from him at all. And he's never been on the show for 3 years. It's not far from Kingswood, Chris. You know, it'd be nice to have you down for our election debate. But anyway, he was on Wednesday at Prime Minister's Questions, asking a question about the M4 link to the Avon Ring Road.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. On Friday, together with local businesses and the Local Enterprise Partnership, I'll be launching a new campaign, Gateway to Growth, calling for a link road to the M4, to the Avon Ring Road, that will help deliver millions of extra in investment, new jobs to the Bristol region, and provide the Kingswood area with the access to the motorway it needs. As part of his long-term economic plan, Minister, look closely at the campaign and a case for an M4 link.
First of all, let me pay tribute to my honourable friend and his very hard work for people in Kingswood and in Bristol more generally. He's absolutely right that we do need to see better transit schemes in Bristol, and I know the Transport Secretary will be happy to look at the campaign and the case he makes. It's also of note, and I'm sure he'd want me to say it, as a great historian and indeed someone who's written about Richard III, we shouldn't let this day pass without noting that, of course, Richard III will be buried tomorrow. It is worth remembering this is the last time someone did in one of their relatives to get the top job, and the country ended in chaos.
So interesting reference to Richard III again there, because I seem to remember at school he was a complete scallywag, and I enjoyed the Shakespeare version of Richard III. He was, of course, behind the Martin, am I right, the killing of the princes in the Tower.
Accused.
Well, yeah, by Sir Thomas More, who was a contemporary.
And by Shakespeare, but
and
don't forget...
Moore also named the three individuals who had gone in and killed the princes, apparently.
Well, maybe so, but don't forget, by that stage you've got Henry VII and the Tudor dynasty had come to power, and most of Shakespeare's plays are sophisticated Tudor propaganda, as we learned at A level.
Final question, Gary, I guess this is for you. Barbados is about to replace the Queen with a ceremonial president. They've had enough. Okay, all right. Thanks very much. We're going to be talking about investigative journalism in the second hour. Thanks very much to our guest in the first hour. You just heard there, Gary Bristol Hopkins. He's the leader of the Lib Dems here on Bristol City Council. And we'll see you after the Murdoch news at 6 o'clock.
BCFM is an award-winning community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour, live from the Sky News Centre.